us. And I think that's the message of solidarity that was the hand that was extended by Xi Jinping to Obama and Trump, and both of them rejected it.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you so much, Harley Schlanger, spokesman of the LaRouche Organization from Potsdam, Germany, and Christopher Halali, a pleasure, researcher and political analyst from Verschaar, Vermont. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for being with us. Kavit Tahweh, and it's goodbye from the entire team here in the capital, Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here, we enlighten you with the Ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wa ma takunu fi sha'nin wa ma tatlu وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وَمَا يَعْزُبُ عَنْ رَبِّكَ مِنْ مِثْقَالِ ذَرَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَمَا يَعْزُبُ عَنْ رَبِّكَ مِنْ مِثْقَالِ ذَرَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا فِي السَّمَاءِ وَلَا أَصْغَرَ مِنْ ذَلِكَ وَلَا أَصْغَرَ مِنْ وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The major European trade union organization boycotts products made in Israeli settlements, urging EU states to ban the import and export of such goods. Sudan's warring sides accuse each other of breaching the latest truce agreement, with violations being reported countrywide. Also coming up, people in the U.S. city of Minneapolis mark the third anniversary of the police killing of black American George Floyd. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: major European trade union organization has announced its decision to boycott products made in Israeli settlements. According to Palestinian media, the decision came during the European Trade Union Confederation's Congress in the German capital, Berlin. The Confederation called for regulatory measures to prevent the European Union's legal entities from importing or exporting products manufactured in Israeli settlements. The body cited the illegality of Israel's West Bank settlements under international law. It also supported the right of the Palestinian people to have an independent state with occupied East al-Quds as its capital. The Confederation represents over 45 million European workers and their trade unions. The UN Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement projects in several resolutions. Palestinian children are the main victim of Israeli onslaughts on the besieged Gaza Strip, as they are facing an endless wave of trauma and an endless wave of fear. Olal Asi reports from Gaza.
During the Tel Aviv regime's 11-day offensive in 2021, Israeli warplanes carried out one of the most horrendous massacres in one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Gaza. The attacks destroyed three residential buildings, killing 44 civilians, including 18 children. Rescue teams took days to pull the bodies from under the rubble. Riyad Shkuntana and his 6-year-old daughter were among the survivors.
When the Israeli warplanes hit the building where we used to live in 2021, we were buried under the destroyed building. I spent 12 hours under the rubble before the rescue team could save me. I could hear the screams of my children calling me from under the debris. But my daughter Susie and I were the only survivors of my family. They told me that my wife and four of my children hadn't been able to make it when they found their bodies.
During the latest Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, the family suffered again. Israeli jet fighters targeted the apartment adjacent to theirs.
I was playing with my cousins in the other room. Suddenly we heard a massive explosion. I directly rushed to my grandma. I was screaming and crying. The house was filled with smoke. I was frightened that the building might fall on us. We realized that the building next to ours was targeted. We escaped from our apartment, and so did all the other residents.
Susie hasn't been able to speak about the 2021 incident ever since it happened. She becomes speechless anytime she remembers what happened to her and her family back then. Her father asserted that there is no safe place in Gaza for his daughter, even though they demanded international protection after the 2021 incident.
It's all lies. Palestinian civilians are never protected from Israeli attacks. We don't trust international protection regulations. She had therapeutic sessions for 2 years, but my daughter is still suffering, and that memory haunts her anytime she hears a loud sound. She deserves to live in peace and security.
Susie Shkuntana is an example of thousands of Palestinian children who suffer from trauma under the Israeli occupation.
According to reports, 90% of Gaza children suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, which indicates the extent of physical and psychological violence they experience under the Israeli occupation. Palestinian children have the right to enjoy a life of peace and safety rather than a life of horror and insecurity. Al Asif, Gaza.
Sudan's warring sides have accused each other of violating the latest ceasefire deal, which was mediated by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. The seven-day truce between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces entered its third day on Thursday. The ceasefire came into effect Monday night and was immediately violated as airstrikes and artillery fire shook the capital, Khartoum. There have been further breaches of the ceasefire agreement since then. The paramilitary RSF issued a statement late Wednesday placing the blame for the breaches on Sudan's army. The army responded Thursday morning saying it had countered an attack on armored vehicles by the RSF in a clear violation of the truce. The violence, which started in mid-April, has so far killed around 1,000 people and displaced over a million others. The two warring factions were former allies and had jointly seized power in a 2021 coup. Turning elsewhere, people in the U.S. city of Minneapolis have marked the third anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. He was an African-American man who was choked to death by a white police officer. Residents of Minneapolis gathered at a makeshift memorial of Floyd. There were signs reading, "Say their names." That's a phrase coined to bring attention to the victims of systematic racism in the U.S. Floyd lost his life after white police officer Derek Chauvin kneeled on his neck for nearly 10 minutes. Chauvin was convicted of murder in 2021. Two other cops who restrained Floyd's knees were jailed as well. Floyd's death sparked widespread protests in the U.S. and abroad. Protesters strongly criticized police brutality against black people in the U.S. and other Western countries. Now, the latest piece of news from U.S. Police brutality against African Americans. Black child Adrian Murray is shot by a Mississippi officer as he responded to the boy's call for help.
We are demanding justice. An 11-year-old black boy in the city of Indianola came within an inch of losing his life. He had done nothing wrong and everything right. His mother asked for him to call the police and call his grandmother.
The incident took place on Saturday. According to Murray's lawyer, he called the police at the request of his mother. She had been threatened by a man who showed up at their house. The mother says the police officer entered their home. He asked everyone to exit, but then he shot her son in the chest. The Mississippi Bureau of Investigation is probing the incident. For now, the officer involved has been placed on paid leave. Murray's mother says he should be fired and charged. An expert study concludes energy poverty killed more people in Europe last winter than COVID-19. EU sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have pushed up energy prices and created a cost of living crisis across the 27-country bloc. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
Official data shows 59,700 people died with COVID-19 in 28 European nations last winter. However, a larger number, 68,000, died because they could not heat their homes. These statistics are startling, but citizens we have been speaking to are not surprised.
Energy poverty is now in Europe and for the world a bigger problem, a much bigger problem than COVID.
I think governments need to make a change into their politics in order to help poor people and also middle class people to face this problem concerning energy.
The Economist magazine study focused on the period from last November to February. Data was gathered from all 27 EU countries except Malta and Cyprus. Britain, Norway and Switzerland were included, however. The bottom line is moves by EU leaders to cut off cheap energy supplies from Russia have had deadly consequences. Meanwhile, the latest figure relating to EU financial support for Ukraine has just been released. Many struggling citizens will find it eye-watering.
If we tot up all the support, military, civilian, humanitarian financial aid, refugee support, if we tot up all of that aid to Ukraine, the EU and its member states have provided 65 billion euros. 65 billion euros.
On Thursday, the European Commission admitted the core inflation rate in the Eurozone, which analysts say is directly linked to sanctions against Russia, remains stubbornly high.
This hits people's purchasing power, especially in lower and middle income groups, and hurts the competitiveness of EU companies.
The European Central Bank continues to increase interest rates to try and bring down inflation. Based on the models, excess deaths relating to high energy costs would have been much higher last winter if weather conditions had not been so mild. It begs the question, how many could die during the forthcoming winter if EU authorities fail to secure reasonably priced, reliable supplies and if conditions turn out to be much colder? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has visited Texas to meet two dozen of the state's leading conservative figures, including politicians, to shore up support for the Ukraine war. A growing number of conservative lawmakers, candidates and activists are now questioning the size of the U.S. assistance for Kiev. The U.S. is the biggest supplier of weapons to Ukraine.
Britain's former Prime Minister has made a controversial trip to the US state of Texas to shore up support for Ukraine. The Center for European Policy Analysis, or the CEPA, a pro-Ukrainian think tank based in Washington, decided to enlist Johnson to push Republicans to support Ukraine. Pro-Ukraine think tankers brought Johnson to a private lunch in Dallas, Texas, to meet two dozen of the state's leading conservative figures, including politicians, donors, and captains of the industry. Johnson's Dallas trip included a visit with former President George W. Bush, in which the two talked about the war in Ukraine. The former UK Prime Minister flew to Texas as a growing number of conservative lawmakers, candidates and activists have started to question the size of the US support package for Ukraine. Johnson has been enlisted because he is said to have been very much seen as the architect of the Western policy on Ukraine. Johnson was a staunch backer of the West's proxy war with Russia during his time in office. He also played a crucial role in ditching peace talks that was held in the early days of the conflict. In April 2022, then Prime Minister Johnson traveled to Kiev and urged Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to stop negotiating with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Moscow has warned that the weapons supplied to Kiev will only prolong the war. Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev has said the weapons will make the world more dangerous. The Kremlin has also said the drive to supply weapons to Kiev will likely trigger what is commonly called a nuclear apocalypse.
Johnson's visit to the U.S. comes amid the backdrop of rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine's Western supporters. Russia has warned that supplying more destructive and advanced weapons by the U.S. and its allies to Ukraine increases the probability of a nuclear apocalypse. Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev, who is currently serving as deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, has said that the more weapons are supplied, the more dangerous the world will be. Earlier this month, the United Kingdom announced during a summit of European leaders that it was working with the Netherlands to build a so-called international jet coalition to help Ukraine obtain F-16 fighter jets from its mostly Western allies.
So apparently they believe that a nuclear conflict or a nuclear apocalypse is impossible because it is never possible. They are wrong. And at some point, events can go completely according to an unpredictable scenario, and the responsibility will lie entirely with the North Atlantic Alliance.
Medvedev's warning came days after American President Joe Biden told fellow G7 leaders in Japan that he supported a joint effort with allies to train Ukrainian pilots on F-16 fighter jets. The U.S. has so far committed $48 billion U.S. dollars in military aid and other assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the war. Washington is the biggest supplier of weaponry to the Ukrainian military. Meanwhile, Russia says it conducted an operation in the border city of Belgorod after Ukraine-based militants staged a sabotage raid there. Russia has said more than 70 attackers were killed in its operation to repel cross-border raiders who entered the country's Belgorod region.
On May 22nd, a unit of the Ukrainian Nationalist Formation invaded the territory of the Russian Federation in the area of the international checkpoint in the Belgorod region. In the course of the counter-terrorist operation, the Nationalist Formations were blocked and defeated by airstrikes, artillery fire, and the active actions of the Western military district units covering the state border. The remaining Nationalists were driven back to the territory of Ukraine, where they were completely eliminated. More than 70 Ukrainian terrorists were eliminated, as well as machinery and armored vehicles.
Russia says the cross-border sabotage was aimed to divert attention away from Bakhmut and minimize Ukraine's losses in the eastern city, which Russian troops claim to have fully captured. The battle over the city has been described as the heaviest to take place between the Russian and Ukrainian forces since last February.
That brings an end to World News for this hour. Thank you for staying with us.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Limelight. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas and the second biggest driver of global warming. A new study shows that only 13% of methane emissions are actually regulated. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. truth out, wrote in this regard, methane, a potent greenhouse gas and the second biggest driver of global warming, after carbon dioxide, at its moment in the spotlight in 2021, over 100 countries signed to Global Methane Pledge to cut emissions by 30% compared to 2020 levels by 2030. This is a useful goal, but the new research shows that something is still missing: stringent policies to eliminate methane emissions. The study is the first global review of methane policies, which have been adopted across the world since 1970s. It reveals that only around 13% of man-made methane emissions from the biggest sources, including agriculture, energy and waste, is regulated by policies capable of controlling and preventing them. This falls to 10% if we take a conservative view of the total emissions and regions covered by specific policies and whether they have been fully or partially implemented. These policies may mandate companies to find and fix methane leaks, install equipment which can capture emissions, charge them for every unit of methane released, or reward them for making use of methane, like extracting biogas from rotting food and other organic waste. The study showed that the majority of policies, about 70%, have been adopted. Methane is over 80 times more powerful in trapping heat in Earth's atmosphere than CO2, but lasts for a much shorter time. Since methane in the air breaks down within about a decade compared to centuries for CO2, phasing out emissions could rapidly reduce the rate at which the planet is heating. For any hope of meeting global climate targets, deep methane reductions are needed immediately. The research shows that countries which have committed to deep cuts must now expand and strengthen policies for eliminating their emissions. The remaining countries should step up their efforts on methane too. Scientists systematically examined policies which have been introduced in 79 countries to reduce methane emissions across farming, solid and liquid waste management, and the energy sectors, including the extraction, transportation and consumption of fossil fuels, coal, oil and gas. Motivations for regulating methane varied. Not only does the gas contribute to climate change, but it can also generate tropospheric ozone, a harmful air pollutant. Methane is also a safety hazard if its concentration in the air reaches an explosive range. But if it is captured, methane becomes a source of energy as a major component of natural gas. And so regulating methane, for example, by incentivizing the capture of methane from coal beds can be cheap and useful. How effective such policies have been is far from clear, though, as countries do not tend to quantify their emissions using direct measurements. Regulations are more frequently used to address fossil, including oil, gas, and coal, rather than biogenic, including livestock, solid, and liquid waste sources of methane. In fact, 41% of all policies targeted methane from coal mines and oil refineries, compared with 25% for farms and landfills. Taxes and charges on the quantities of waste, for example, are more common for regulating biogenic sources, whereas financial incentives, like feed-in tariffs for electricity generated from captured coal mine methane, are more frequently used in fossil methane policies. Policies targeting methane emissions from the oil and gas sector tend to be more stringent than those targeting coal mines. Similarly, policies targeting methane emissions from solid and liquid waste are more stringent than those addressing livestock emissions. These divergent approaches to regulating different methane sources may be the result of opposition from the fossil fuel and agricultural industries. The relative importance of these industries to national and regional economies and energy and food supply may also explain why government regulation has so far proved inadequate. More stringent policies and a consistent approach for quantifying how much methane is being emitted from each source will be key to bringing regulation in line with global commitments. Improving the monitoring of methane emissions is particularly important for enabling deeper cuts. Historically, methane emissions have been difficult and costly to measure, partly because it is an invisible gas and compared to CO2, only minor emissions cause substantial warming. However, methane reduction is still often perceived by policymakers as a choice rather than a necessary complement to ongoing decarbonization efforts focused on CO2. Within almost every sector, there are major methane sources that have been largely overlooked. These include the digestive gases of cows and other livestock, methane from the ventilation shafts of coal mines, high-emitting sources in the oil and gas sector, and from abandoned mines and oil and gas wells. In the energy sector, emissions from non-operated joint ventures are particularly neglected by regulation. This is a type of business structure where a company owns an equity interest without assuming day-to-day operational control. These are usually owned by major oil and gas companies, but operated by local partners. National oil and gas firms in developing countries are a prime example. Supply chains are another important source, particularly with internationally traded commodities like liquefied natural gas, LNG, and cooking coal used in steelmaking. In the oil and gas sector, where methane may be more cost-effective to reduce because the captured gas could be monetized, global commitments like the Paris Agreement require the industry's own emissions to fall alongside falling demand for fossil fuels across all economies.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Midstream.
Possible hope for the Jeddah summit and the preceding shifts in Arab and regional relations may be that it will establish a kind of stability in the region after a decade full of wars that exhausted countries and peoples and caused destruction, waves of displacement, an unprecedented decline in the living standards, and the growth of extremism. If stability is the first side of the triangle of the regional system that is currently taking shape, then the other two sides are represented in other problems, not the least of which is the compulsory development project in parallel with the stability of regional repressive regimes. This was clearly evident in the words delivered at Jeddah's Arab League summit last week, which sounded like an obituary paper for the so-called Arab Spring. In any case, it can be said that the moment for Syria, the state, has already arrived. Syria, which faced an expected internal crisis, but its political components wanted it as an entry point for forced change with fire and steel. Riyadh not only sought to return Damascus to the League of Arab States before the Jeddah summit, but it also insisted on the participation of President Bashar al-Assad personally to hold the Arabs for the first time, a meeting with a strategic economic dimension affecting regional politics. The most important thing remains that this event took place far from the West's control and permanent obstruction of the reconstruction of Syria and the return of the displaced Syrians. In addition to its historical immediate ambitions for controlling its geographical location and looting Syria's resources. However, the breakthroughs we are witnessing today cannot be considered the end of the Arab-Arab wars. But rather, an announcement of the failure of the American-dominated project to subjugate many countries. We now hear nice talk about forgiveness, pardon, and reunion, but we must be very cautious about any upcoming calls to abandon basic principles under the pretext of the Persian Gulf countries' urgent need for development, which requires broad regional stability. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. President Bashar al-Assad is not the only Arab leader who arrived in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia last week for the League of Arab States meeting at the level of state leaders, held on Friday, May 19. However, without any doubt, the arrival of President Assad on a presidential plane to Jeddah airport seemed to be the most prominent event prior to the summit, as it won the widest media coverage, as well as the interest of Arab observers, analysts, and others. Western observers who had followed and covered the Syrian file throughout the years of the war went as far as observing the takeoff, flight path, and landing of the Syrian presidential plane, commenting on that through their Twitter accounts in terms filled with disappointment and frustration. To discuss this issue with us from Damascus is a favorite guest of mine, Ms. Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist and political commentator. Thank you very much, Vanessa, for being with us on the Middle East Stream. Now, almost 12 years after his country's membership in the Arab League was suspended on November 2011, how do you assess the speech of the Syrian president, Dr. Bashar Assad, who shined in Syria's designated seat at the Arab League summit in Jeddah last week, which he delivered in his name and on behalf of the Syrian Arab Republic, his country emerging victorious from the furnace of the war?
Well, I mean, you know, this event was quite extraordinary. There have been a number of extraordinary events also leading up to the Arab League summit. But, you know, if the West expected President Assad to arrive cap in hand to a league of countries, many of which, of course, were responsible for the devastation and destabilization in Syria since 2011, they would be sorely disappointed. This, in fact, was a triumphant re-entry of one of the founding members of the Arab League, and President Assad's speech was far from, apologetic in any way at all. On the contrary, he very much took control of the summit. He very much set the tone of the future of the summit. And he very much, through diplomatic language and through terminology which was very subtle but could not be mistaken, he made it very clear who was to blame for, the fracturing of Arabism, the fracturing of the unity of Arab nations throughout history. He was very clear about how Western intervention should be prevented at all costs. He was very clear about the fact that Arab unity was the way forward, both for all Arab nations, and that includes resource-rich Arab nations. Of course, what the West was always terrified of was a unity of these nations that basically had control of the world's commodities. And now what we're seeing after decades of the West trying to destroy pan-Arabism, we're seeing a re-emergence of pan-Arabism led by the Syrian Arab Republic and President Assad. And I think what was very important, the phrase that he used, Syria is the heart of Arabism, but it's also in its heart. And I think that phrase alone describes exactly both President Assad's vision that has always been so since he came to the presidency in 2000. And really, it gives optimism and hope for the future of Arabism, of the unity of Arab states, the strength of the resistance now behind the Palestinian cause, and also the ability of these nations to prevent Western devastating intervention.
Vanessa, what was really interesting to me was that Riyadh sought the return of Damascus to the League of Arab States before the Jeddah summit and insisted on the participation of President Bashar al-Assad personally in that summit so that the Arabs would be holding some sort of a meeting that's both strategic and maybe economic, possibly for the first time in decades. But it also became some sort of a two-way summit, an Arab summit and Syria and what Syria represents with, on the other hand, a Saudi Arabia summit. But where does all of this, do you see the West fitting itself, or is there no more place for the West?
Years ago when I met with President Assad with a U.S. peace delegation in 2016, President Assad said one thing that has always remained with me. He said, you know, the Americans are so far up the lie tree, we have to give them a way to get down where they don't feel completely denigrated, right? And this is what Syria represents. Syria represents not only the principle of resistance, the integrity of resistance, but also forgiveness. Syria has never lost its moral compass. Its door is always open, as we've seen at the Arab League, even to those that were previously enemies and who were responsible for much of the bloodshed in Syria. Will that door be open to the West? I believe so in the future, but with conditions. And as President Assad said, we need to stop being reactionary. We need to anticipate. That's, again, a very important phrase. Because Middle Eastern policy has usually been reactionary, and it hasn't studied strategy, and it hasn't anticipated events that are being orchestrated by the West. So will the West have a role? Only if the West complies with the new philosophy of West Asia and the emerging multipolar order.
They don't seem like doing that, because it was very fast that we saw the Foreign Relations Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives last week approving a draft law. It's not even a law yet, but they were working day and night on an anti-normalization draft law. Syria threatening even their closest allies with sanctions if they normalize with Syria, if they start relations with Damascus. I mean, most notably expanding the scope of the so-called Caesar's Act, and extending it for a new 8 years up until 2032. What does this move mean for the new Arab-Syria relations, which were specifically forged during the Arab summit, and I mean Saudi Arabia?
Yeah. Well, you know, the West is looking actually increasingly desperate. As Marco Rubio said very recently, if these countries continue on the de-dollarization path, then our economic warfare will become redundant. And that's the point. You know, President Assad in recent meetings has been pushing for de-dollarization and for movement towards other currencies to basically exclude the West from being able to carry out this kind of economic siege warfare. We've seen countries actually during the earthquake come to the aid of Syria and defy the Caesar sanctions, which threaten to carry out punitive measures against countries that will show any kind of normalization towards Syria. So the West is rapidly actually becoming redundant in this area. And coming up with this bill right now, it kind of looks ridiculous with the level of normalization. You have, for example, the rejuvenation of the Kirkuk to Banias pipeline. You have projects for rail networks to go from Iran through Iraq into Syria. You know, West Asia is rebuilding itself without the West. This is the point. It has Russia and China behind it now, investing heavily in these networks that threaten to basically exclude Western supremacy and hegemony in the region. And Russia even now is bombing positions of terrorist groups that are U.S. proxies around Al-Tanf. There are attacks being carried out against the Kurdish Contras in the northeast. You know, the U.S. is losing its grip. And when an empire starts to lose its grip, it starts to do things that are irrational and illogical, as we've seen in Ukraine. But the future, the writing is on the wall for the future, particularly of West Asia and for multipolarity. And the U.S. Is still battling against the reality that is coming into the horizon. And let's see how well it does. Mm-hmm.
Well, as a Levantine Arab myself, I do hope for the best. I do hope for peace in our region, especially after the long years that Syria has suffered. But yet it survived and it came out victorious. And that's what makes us hold our heads high and wish for the best for the entire region. We don't wish ill for anyone. We just want the entire region to stand up in unity together. I want to thank you very, very much, Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist and photographer, for joining us from Damascus to discuss this very important issue, which is the rejuvenation of ties between Syria and the Arab world. Now, please stay tuned with us, because right now after the break, we will be discussing the aftermath of the Revenge of the Free operation of Gaza against the occupation.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The battle of Revenge of the Free has ended, but the war has not ended, and it will not end until the sun of Palestine rises and a round of struggle of the free with tyrants has stopped. The struggle has not stopped and will not stop with the Zionist entity until its scorching sun sets. The Islamic Jihad movement in Palestine, along with the resistance movements, fought a heroic battle, introducing the duty above the possible principle from which its resistance project was launched, based on the bright side of the nation's history, its human heritage, and its revolutionary standard. More details in this following report.
Calm prevailed in the Gaza Strip after a ceasefire agreement entered into force between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli occupation, mediated by Egypt after 5 days of the Israeli aggression on the Strip, which began on May 8, during which 33 Palestinians were killed and dozens were injured. While the occupation authorities announced the killing of a settler and a foreign worker and the injury of dozens. As the Israeli aggression ended, the nature and size of the response initiated by the Palestinian resistance seems to have constituted an uncalculated surprise to the Israeli political and military levels. This proved the error of the estimates of the occupation security services, which believed that the round of aggression against Gaza would end in some sort of victory, and presented it to the Israeli public opinion to stop the decline in popularity of the occupation and its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Throughout the last battle, Israel pinned its hopes on the Egyptian intelligence to succeed in achieving a ceasefire that would remain steadfast, as it seemed, not for the first time, if I may, that it was easier for the Israeli regime to start a military operation in Gaza than to end it. Despite the occupation's clear military superiority, Israel faced difficulty in dictating an exit strategy from the military operation, as it was clear to the Zionist entity that it would not gain much from the continuation of the military aggression. On the contrary, the continuation of the battle entailed a danger to decision makers at the Israeli political level, that the continued firing of rockets on the Israeli home front could lead the public to lose its patience and decline its support for these steps. On the other hand, the Palestinian resistance adopted a new strategy represented in postponing the response and draining the entity for as long as possible and over long hours, amid the continued erosion of the entity's strength, which was clearly evident during the last period. In that context, the head of the Hamas political bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, confirmed in a TV interview last week that the resistance has proven its ability to thwart the arrogance of the occupation, whether by singling out the Al-Quds brigades or putting a wedge between the resistance forces that realized its goals and worked unified and in harmony. For its part, the Quds Brigades, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad, mourned its 11 martyrs who rose in the heroic battle of revenge of the free, noting that the right of its righteous martyrs came to confirm the presence of the equation of duty in action and the revolutionary awareness of its heroes who performed their duty. The joint room of the Palestinian resistance factions also said in a statement that the hand of the resistance was supreme in the equation of force and deterrence, so it rained down hundreds of missiles and artillery shells on the enemy, emphasizing that the resistance entered this battle and emerged from it unified and strong like a solid structure, and wrote a new epic of steadfastness, sacrifice, and heroism.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Jamal Zahran, political science professor at Port Said University and Egypt coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. Thank you very much, Dr. Zahran, for being with us. Now, was the leadership of the Islamic Jihad movement and its military wing, Al-Quds Brigade, able to succeed in reducing the effects of the military gap, separating it from the occupation army, after being able to absorb the surprise strike represented in targeting a number of the movement's military leaders?
I believe that the Islamic Jihad movement, which was recently targeted by the Zionist entity, succeeded to a large extent in threatening the Zionist entity and making it feel ashamed, after some of its leadership were assassinated in Gaza, especially the three seniors at the beginning of the Battle of the Revenge of the Free, who were close to discussing several vital issues with Egypt. So the Zionist entity targeted and killed them and killed their families. So three military leaders and 15 of their family members were brutally murdered. Then the assassinations continued until they reached 10 other leaders. The Zionist entity behind these assassinations, which he uses in a form of policy that is renewed from time to time. What Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir wanted from behind this policy to split the back of the jihad movement. But the Islamic Jihad is a movement that was born with leaders and was able to overcome this crisis and direct missiles at the heart of Tel Aviv and other settlements. More than 1,200 missiles were fired at the Zionist entity and were able to confuse the so-called Iron Dome. More than 70% of these missiles were able to reach their targets and achieve their goals and cause panic among the colonial settlers. Consequently, the Islamic Jihad has proven that it is able to overcome any crisis that surrounds it on the part of the Zionist entity. Rather, it has reached the stage of full coordination with all the resistance factions, such as Hamas and others, to send a message to the Zionist entity that sedition between the resistance factions is one that does not work. They have the heart of one man and follow one line of resistance. I personally went and offered condolences upon my arrival to Beirut to the brother leader Ziyad Nakhali, and we consoled him on both this painful and proud occasion.
Well, Dr. Zahran, as you just said, the Islamic Jihad did prove its ability to continue firing rockets all the way to Tel Aviv, showing the limited capabilities of the occupation's air force in this field, in addition to Israel's failure to deal with the rocket launches, if the confrontation also maybe included Hamas movement in Gaza, or if it let alone rolled to the north against Hezbollah in Lebanon. How do you assess the Zionist occupation's position and Netanyahu's government in specific following the revenge of the free battle?
The battle lasted for 5 days, from 8 to 13 of May, when the Israeli entity appealed to the Egyptian government to intervene to stop the firing of these missiles. So as long as the occupation government appealed to Egypt, this means that it suffered a severe defeat, which illustrates its inability to confront these missiles. This means that the Iron Dome was not able to hunt the missiles of the resistance. Rather, it proved its failure, despite its development for three generations. But it failed to stop the missiles of the resistance in Gaza. I believe that the Islamic Jihad's coordination was not only with resistance organizations inside Gaza, but also with careful coordination with the West Bank and with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and coordination with Syria on the Golan Front as well. That is, if the battle had lasted more than 5 days, Israel would have been heavily damaged. With an expected doomsday war against the Zionist entity, I believe that the Al-Jihad movement proved its own ability and the ability of its military arm, the Al-Quds Brigade, and also proved its ability to coordinate with others and prevent the sedition that Israel was targeting it with, by focusing on striking the backbone of the Islamic Jihad, and this is what Israel failed to do.
Well, this is where I want to end off with, because this just translates the concept of unity of the battlefields, because Gaza is linked to the West Bank, is linked to the Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa mosques. It's one unified resistance inside of Palestine and historic occupied Palestine as well. But are there any more aggression cards in the hands of the Zionist entity that they can play with, given the fact that it currently feels maybe engulfed by the entire axis of resistance? They feel helpless. Might they do something stupid?
Of course, the actions of the Zionist leaders, Netanyahu in the foreground, and with him those he chose, such as Ben-Gavir, who is characterized by aggression, whom are originally terrorist figures present on Palestinian land through occupation, settlement, and racial discrimination, they all react on the background of irrational behavior, and irrationality falls under aggressive behavior, as they will continue to prove themselves stupid. They are very upset because the resistance's missiles are hitting them inside. Because when we watched the videos that were released during the Revenge of the Free battle, the settlers' panic was very clear, as the trenches were full of colonial settlers. Even some of the media people of the occupying entity, who were puffing their chests high as if they were not afraid or fearful, were forced to enter the shelters. We all saw these videos on social media. Every day, the occupation leaders prove that they are unable to continue with this entity, and that the great decisive battle is coming soon. Every day, the occupying entity proves that it is the isolated one, not the resistance movements. On the contrary, the resistance movements have the ability to coordinate, so that all squares around the occupation entity have become mobilized against this entity in order to remove it soon, God willing.
Well, Dr. Jamal Zahran, a former Member of Parliament of Egypt and the political science professor at Port Said University, and also Egypt's coordinator of the global gathering in support of the choice of resistance, I want to thank you very much for being our guest tonight to talk about the aftermath of the Revenge of the Free battle that happened in Palestine. Hopefully this battle will be the beginning of the end of the Zionist entity. Ladies and gents, I want to thank you very much. Please stay up, stay tuned. Next week, we will always be giving you new up-to-date information about the region of West Asia on the Middle East. I'll see you again. Assalamu alaikum.
in the limelight.
A new poll has found that the US media is disconnected from the American public. The poll suggested that Americans don't believe narratives on Russiagate or that the Biden family was not engaged in corruption. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, most Americans believe the Russiagate investigation of Donald Trump was based on lies and that President Joe Biden's family engaged in influence-peddling crimes, a new Harvard CAPS Harris poll has shown, suggesting that legacy media outlets have failed to sway public opinion. The poll released recently found that 56% of U.S. voters believe the claim that Trump colluded with Russia to win the 2016 presidential election was a false story. The same percentage believed the Steele dossier, which was the basis for an FBI investigation of Trump's campaign, was false. Nearly 7 in 10 respondents said they weren't surprised that the Durham report released earlier this month found that the FBI violated its own standards in starting the Trump-Russia investigation and became a funnel for disinformation from Democrat candidate Hillary Clinton's campaign.